Welcome to an enlightening podcast from IslamPodcasts.com. We encourage our listeners to please comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please remind your family and friends to also visit IslamPodcasts.com for engaging discussions on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran, tafsir, seerah, and much more. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Podcasts on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran tafsir, and seerah are available at islampodcasts.com as well as on iTunes. Rate, review, and comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please subscribe, share, and tell a friend about islampodcasts.com as well as rate, review of iTunes.
Brother Uthman Badr is the spokesman for Hizb al-Tahrir. He is doing his PhD in economics at University of Western Sydney and also teaching at the same university. Hizb al-Tahrir is a very well-known political Islamic organization. It's 60 years old now, and it's quite controversial because of what it espouses and the fact that it's been banned in a number of European countries. Most of the Muslims, most of the participants of Hizb al-Tahrir in Muslim countries have been jailed, tortured, and murdered for their political beliefs. And so, as always, there's always a talk in Australia of banning them and of basically throwing them to the wolves. So what we're going to talk to Brother Uthman about today is generally the nature of the media, and specifically about the experiences that Hizb al-Tahrir has had with the media and with Brother Uthman as well. So Brother Uthman, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
It's a pleasure to have you at our studios.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Jazakumullah khairan. So let's start with yourself. How long have you been a spokesman for Hizb al-Tahrir? I know that Wasim Durahi was a spokesman before you. So how did you come to fill his shoes?
Yeah, I think it's been 3 or 4 years now. It was just a change of roles. Wasim moved on to greener pastures and left me with the unenviable task of dealing with the media.
Yeah. So, so far, are you destroyed? Do you want someone else to take your...
No. It's been okay. It's been good. It's a very interesting role. There's always new and interesting challenges. I've tried to open up new avenues like opinion pieces and non-mainstream media as well as the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly an interesting task, but at the end of the day, we take this as work, as da'wah. Mm. It's not a field of choice.
Yep.
But a lot of responsibility and obligation, so we'll take it from that perspective.
Yeah. Now, I remember once that Hamza Yusuf defined da'wah as calling of Islam to non-Muslims rather than calling Muslims to come back to religion. So, but the sentiments that come out of Hizb al-Tahrir are not da'wah related at all. They're quite aggressive.
Yeah, there's a couple of different references to da'wah in the Islamic tradition. What Sheikh Hamza is speaking about there is the da'wah that most of us know, the individual level of da'wah, but otherwise da'wah is a broader term that refers to calling towards Allah. So we just make a distinction between the individual da'wah and the da'wah of societies.
Yep.
So when we use the word da'wah, what we mean is calling societies to implement Islam, and it's got nothing to do with the individuals of calling Muslims or non-Muslims. Otherwise, we agree that if you're calling a Muslim to practice, that's not called da'wah, it's enjoying the good, nasiha, etc., etc.
Okay, khair, inshallah. And so this is basically Hizb al-Tahrir's message, is da'wah to non-Muslims?
No. Our message is that we are calling the society to implement Islam. Yeah. And in fact, this is we make a very important distinction between the individual level da'wah, which is important in Islam and has its own role, but that's not the method to bring about societal change by individual numbers one after the other, and between calling a society. And this is important. I think it'll come out in our discussion because a lot of the controversy comes out not when you're calling an individual, private discussions, individual one-on-one, but when you are calling the entire society and engaging in what we would call the intellectual and political struggle, the battle for hearts and minds and ideas.
How do you think you're faring so far in the battle for hearts and minds in Australia?
In Australia, we don't separate the various provinces in which we operate, or the various countries in which we operate. Overall in the globe, I think it's been quite successful from the perspective of public opinion and the ideas. And a simple way to measure that would be that, you know, talk of the caliphate in the 50s, people said you're crazy, and in fact they said to Sheikh Taqiyuddin al-Nabhani that he was crazy, what is he talking about? And you can imagine if you put yourself back in that context where there's a big struggle between capitalism and socialism, and that's the be-all and end-all of what anyone knows, and you're saying, no, they're both wrong, we've got to return back to Islam in this very particular form. So whereas now, even Western surveys have shown that Muslim public opinion across the world, in East and West, calls for the establishment of Islam, and particularly even there's been surveys using the word caliphate, which are in very large numbers of majorities, calling for and in favour of this type of change in the Muslim world.
So what's the role of then Hizb ut-Tahrir in Australia? Considering it's a non-Muslim society and...
Yeah, in origin, because the role of Hizb ut-Tahrir as an organisation, and we are the same all around the world, is the reception of the caliphate in the Muslim world. Our role, therefore, in Australia is to supplement or complement the work that goes on over there. And that's done by, for example, things like the government here has a major role that it plays over there, as is the case with America or Europe, accounting their foreign policy and so on and so forth. But there's also another role, which is that because we do live in non-Islamic societies, there's a lot of pressures that force or that are imposed upon Muslims towards integration, assimilation, and so on and so forth, to try and engage in that battle of ideas, to resist those pushes, and to preserve the Muslim identity at spheres, particularly at spheres which others perhaps don't work in. So, you know, fiqh and all that, things aside.
Yeah.
But the discussion we have, values, Australian Muslims, integration, non-integration, political participation, elections, and all that sort of,
yeah,
all those areas.
Just stopping for a moment at Australian values, this is something that I want to expand into further on, inshallah. So yeah, we'll just put that into
on the bench.
On the bench, yeah. I was going to say on the board, but that's okay.
So can you elaborate more on your role with Hizb ut-Tahrir in Australia? So you're the media representative.
Yep.
So what does that entail, essentially?
Well, essentially...
Sorry, just before you start, Brother Uthman, to our listeners, if anyone of you wants to call to ask a question or to contribute, you can do so by calling us on 9724-3355. Sorry to interrupt you there, Brother. Go ahead, please.
Essentially, the role of media representative is to represent the organisation in the mainstream media. And what that means is, obviously, we call for our ideas in the society at large. So that means we interact on the individual level, at the level of the community, at the level of government, of media, academia, and etc. So this is a particular role, and there are other roles for other areas of interaction with the media. And obviously it's important because the media happens to be the main medium of communicating ideas in a society. So issuing press releases, instigating a discussion on new topics, writing opinion pieces, and the like, because it's the type of the work that I do.
Yeah, I've noticed on your website that you've wrote a couple of sort of statements, and I think the last one that you wrote was about the draconian laws deliver injustice and put Islam on trial.
Yeah.
So can
it's a press release.
Sorry?
It's a press release.
Oh, press release, yeah. Sorry. Oh, it doesn't really say that here.
Okay.
It's okay.
It says breaking. No, it doesn't say that either.
It's fine. Don't worry about it. Just ask questions.
So can you tell me more about that? So tell me more about the trial and what your...
Yeah, well, that's a good example of the type of issues that we deal with. So we've had anti-terror laws instituted in this country following 9/11. It started the process, but really picked up after 2005, after the bombings in London, because policymakers here thought, oh my God, there's a homegrown threat, we need to do something. So these laws have been instituted, and our assessment of it, and assessment even of other Muslim and non-Muslim interested parties, has been that a lot of this has been politicized. It's been a political implementation as opposed to a legal or a security-based one. So these laws have then been used to make examples of individuals in a number of terrorism cases that have occurred in Sydney and Melbourne. And so, in fact, I think we've commented on probably all of the ones that there's been convictions and sentences in. They're all different, but there is a common thread through them where the lower standards of the new laws have been used to come up to convictions and very harsh sentences for crimes or for actions which, in the pub, without these laws, would probably not even have been convictable in the first instance. So So the idea is the conviction has happened in the media. The media's come out and said, oh, my God, there's these terrorists and the police has been successful and the law has been successful in putting them aside. And so we're coming and saying, oh, hang on a minute, let's take a step back here. Even you know, lawyers, judges, ex-high court judges, civil libertarians, they were all up in arms when these laws were instituted. And now, just because convictions are being made under them, we're all ignoring this and we're saying, oh, geez, terrorists off the street. What these people have done is plan a conspiracy to do something, and you're giving them 18 years or 20 years. So there's a discussion that needs to be had, and the idea is to instigate that and to put out an opinion on that basis.
In relation to that press release, yep, in particular, I've noticed that you use like terms such as, paragraph 6 says, we advise Muslims in Australia not to be caught up in this hysteria and these witch hunts. I mean, what's the effect of using words such as witch hunts? I mean, it's a very sort of emotive words. It's not very objective.
Yep.
It's very, very subjective and causes some emotional response.
That's right. Well, that's the work of politics. And the idea is, number one, because it's a press release and you're dealing with the media, you have to be concise. You have to be to the point and you have to get the message across in the shortest amount of words possible. And so you do want to also get across the right idea, and we do believe these are witch hunts, right? But obviously witch hunts are in the political terminology, not in the fact that there's witches and they're trying to be hunted down. But the idea is that these are people that are being made an example of without there actually being a basis for these convictions and these harsh sentences that are being put through. So that's why that sort of terminology is used.
Did you read the transcript or did you have...
Yes.
So you read the transcript of the proceedings?
Yeah, with most of these... Actually, with this one, the transcript wasn't out at the time of the press release. There was commentary in the media, and so we had to go off the actual quotations as opposed to the journalist's own opinion.
Quotations usually are out of context.
Yeah, but the quotations that were given by judges, you have to do your best to try and put them in context. But obviously we do our best to get our hands on those transcripts. I, in fact, call the High Court, the Victorian Supreme Court, asking them why isn't it out. Usually you put it out when the sentence goes out, and the registrar couldn't help him beyond saying, oh, look, it'll take another week, 2 weeks, maybe longer. In fact, it took much longer than that for it to come out. But in most other instances, yes, we read the transcript, we go through. In fact, we've been following the case from the very beginning. It's not the sentencing is the last part. The case, even when people are arrested, it's in the media.
Mm.
And then when they go to court and then when something's development, it's a long process that you have to follow quite closely.
Do you have lawyers following this up, or is it just yourselves?
No, well, because we're not involved ourselves it's not a case that we're fighting. There's no lawyers involved. Yes, when we need to seek legal advice, we have access to lawyers that we can use. But thus far in these sort of cases, it's not a legal issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's enough out there that shows it's a political issue.
Yep.
And superficial reading on a following of these issues and the transcripts and the law and so forth shows what is the reality behind what's happening.
Yep. I've got a question as well. I've always noticed that whenever Hizb ut-Tahrir comes, there is an unreserved attack by any organization, many of the Christian Jewish organizations, many politicians as well, attack you like there's no tomorrow. It becomes like a sort of a cool thing to bash Hizb ut-Tahrir. It doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter what they stand for. It doesn't even matter that every time they come out, they say, we're not calling for the establishment of Khalifa in Australia, but in Muslim countries. There's always that attack. How do you guys deal with that misinformation? And do you think it's just answer me that question, because I've got another larger question after that as well.
How do we deal with that?
Yeah.
Well, to be honest, we expect that in the first instance, and I think that'll become clearer if we have the discussion about the nature of the media itself. And it's not just our group. There are other Muslims, individuals and organizations that also...
The reason I'm asking you that, Uthman, is because Hizb ut-Tahrir is systematic, it's organized, it's clear about what it says, it doesn't change its mind.
Yep.
The other people that are being attacked, they're being attacked for... Allahu Alam, for good reason, because they said really stupid things, because the things that they say are nonsensical even to Muslims.
Mm. So in some cases, in others,
otherwise. In many cases, Allahu Alam about them.
Yeah. In any case, the point is, the common point between the two is that what the people are attacking what these non-Muslims are attacking, whether they be Christians or Jews or the journalists or secularists or liberals, is the message. They're not interested in Hizb ut-Tahrir as a name. I can't even pronounce it properly. Well, they're interested in the ideas, and they know the ideas we call for, and the ideas we call for, and our key message touches at the essence of the struggle that is ablaze between secular liberalism and Islam globally in the modern era, in our era that we live in now. So the call for the caliphate, the call for the implementation of Sharia in the Sharia law, sorry, in the Muslim world. Our opinions on, you know, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and so on and so forth, which goes beyond just saying we're against the war. Right, so socialists say they were against the war, but we're saying we're against the war. The Australian intervention is wrong. Australian troops must come home. The Muslims over there have a right to resist, and the alternative is the caliphate. So it's because people know after a while that these are the key messages, and they understand because it's systematic, right? Because it's systematic, because it's organized. Because if you have a lone player, it doesn't really make sense. He's just out there because he's going to make a bit of noise. He's going to go on. People don't, you're not going to take him seriously. But the one who is organized, who is systematic, who is global, who has an organized effort, you take that seriously. And it's not a coincidence that they deal with us in the way that they do.
Okay. Another question I had also because of the attack that's on you. You always called for the implementation of Sharia, while others also call for a demented implementation, like the story that came out a couple of months ago of a guy who's had, you know, a bunch of brothers coming into his house and belting the crap out of him. Now, this, as far as I understand, is not Sharia, because Sharia is a civil code. It you know, it's part of a state. People don't just go around willy-nilly beating up others. But yet they found people who came out and said, this is Sharia and I support it fully. Right? So do you have, I mean, yeah. Do you find yourself that you have to keep clarifying or defining what Sharia is? I mean, there's so many people who say, you know, who have different opinions about what Sharia could be. So do you, you know, struggle with this sort of thing with the media? I mean, it must get very tiring having to clarify yourself all the time.
The work overall is tiring because it's repetitive, obviously. But that's the nature of the beast. But the answer to your question is yes and no. On the one hand, yes, we do clarify. We do make out the point, but we make it a point that our approach is not defensive or apologetic. So we don't keep saying, you know, Islam is a message of peace. No, we're not terrorists because Islam means peace, and it's like this. It's like we make it a point that we're making it a positive, confident approach. This is Islam, and no, Muslims are not the issue. You guys are the issue. It's not the terrorist who blows up someone in Afghanistan. It's you guys who have gone in and invaded the country, and you've killed tens of thousands of people, and now you want us to focus on the reaction. Right? Not that we're justifying the reaction, but why are you talking about the reaction whilst you're ignoring the original provocation? So usually our repetition is on trying to put the focus where we think it belongs, which is on the original aggression. And again, obviously that takes the ire of the media, of politicians, and so on and so forth. But we don't sort of adopt this approach of trying to be defensive and redefining in that sense as such.
So what's the effect been so far in terms of how have people responded, or the media responded to Hizb ut-Tahrir?
Well, the media responded in the way, as I said, we expected to respond, which is a very, a very hostile.
Okay, so there's no positive.
Well, there is probably I mean, I don't want to paint the whole media with the same brush, but by and large, I think it's justified to paint the media with the same brush. There are some exceptions. So, for example, there's some. John Cleary at the ABC, he calls me every now and then to have a discussion on Sunday nights on his religious program, which is an hour-long discussion with a panel of, you know, academics or people who know their stuff. Opinion pieces that I write for The Drum, the ABC, again, I think it's a slightly better avenue, but they are the exception to the rule. By and large, the media, not only because it's anti-Islamic, but because that's the nature of the media, but because Islam is antithetical to secular liberalism, which defines the paradigms within which the media works and the establishment of which it is a part, it's exacerbated in the case of Islam and Muslims. So what I mean by the nature of the media, I mean now the media is no longer interested primarily in accurate reporting. It's interested by it's a business model. It's interested in profits. and that means sensationalism, and that means inaccurate reporting on all fronts, not just Islam and Muslims, on all fronts. In fact, there was a survey last year by Essential Research and people, they surveyed Australians, and they think it was like 69% saying the media is biased across the board, and 59% saying it's inaccurate reporting across the board. But as I said, with Islam, what happens is it's thought that the media is it's a neutral body that sort of passes on the news and people make judgments, but it's not. It's part of the establishment, and it is defined by those very same boundaries, which are secular, which are liberal, and therefore Islam forms the quintessential other, if you will. And therefore, it's sensational in the first instance. Islam is the perfect enemy, if you will. And so when the two come together, you should expect a hostile approach, and that's exactly what we get.
Okay. Something I wanted to ask as well. We've been talking to a lot of people about the media, and we get different understandings of how it operates. So, for example, when we spoke to Brother Zakaria Matthews, he mentioned that a lot of the the misreporting, I guess you could call it, comes from not so much a campaign of misinformation about Islam, but from the fact that people don't understand, or their ideas about Islam are ingrained from years of other types of media and movies, etc. While I've had another person tell me that the way it's done in newspapers, for example, or in magazines, that a person would write something and would submit that article to editors or sub-editors, and then these sub-editors would add the party line to it, if you will.
Right.
So what's your perspective on this?
Yeah, I probably lean towards a second opinion. I don't think it's a case of good journalists versus bad journalists, or journalists in the know and journalists who are just ignorant. It's because it's been so long, and the campaign is so sustained against Islam and anything to do with Islam and Muslims. So the way I understand the media works is, as I said, number one, it's a business model across the board.
Yep.
So and number two, there are ideological boundaries, as I said, which are defined by it's being secular, it's being liberal, and therefore Islam forms the opposites to these. And then what happens is, obviously, even if there is someone that wants to, in the first instance, so most of these journalists, the idea that comes across to them when you say something about Islam, particularly on where there are differences, like the caliphate, like Sharia law, like jihad, and so on and so forth, the starting point is already that they have a different idea and that they disagree. But even if they were to write a neutral piece, as you said, it will go to the editor, it will go to the sub-editors, it will go to... And there is a line along the way push. And in fact, I've seen this with specific articles where over time you see the line, for example, the Telegraph is going to push or the Sun Herald is going to push. Not only the line, in fact, sometimes there's specific paragraphs that any article about us, it ends with the same paragraph. So even when a new journalist writes an article, you know he's writing something else, but in the end you've seen his paragraph, so you know the editor's done their bit.
Over the last, how many years have you been doing this?
Three or four.
And how many years has Wasim been doing it?
How many years did he do it? I'm not sure, to be honest.
There
wasn't anyone before him, so...
Was he, did he start from 9/11, or was he before that?
Probably after that.
After that, okay.
So
over the 7-8 years that have passed, have you noticed any change at all? I mean, you're saying that Hizb ut-Tahrir, for example, which is, I guess, an organization with a clearer, method of communication that, what you say is very clear and honest. Have you noticed any changes in the way the media perceives you, or even in the, the presenters that keep, bringing onto their shows? Is there a better understanding, or are they exactly the same way as they were before?
No, I think there is a better understanding, but it's not in the way that now there's a better understanding, so we can expect less hostility. There's better understanding, but that will only sharpen the approach that they take against us. But there has been better because of the sustained commentary, the sustained approach that we've taken. So, for example, to give a concrete example, in fact, I think you mentioned it as well. Before, they used to always mention, start with Hizb ut-Tahrir, it's banned he, and he, and half of those he, and he would be wrong. Right? So, for example, you said we're banned in most European countries. We're not banned in any European country at all.
Really? Weren't you banned in Belgium?
No. No country at all, except in Germany, where there's a ban on association, but not on on public activities, but not on actually being a member of the party. That's the only thing that there is in Europe.
Yeah.
So generally, the media would always start off by saying, "Oh, banned in Europe, banned here, banned there." And the only place where we were ever banned was in the Arab, under the tyrants in the Muslim world. But we always made a point of this, so we would make a point, even if it was just one sentence, that saying this is an error of fact. And we've seen over time they don't say that anymore. They don't repeat those. In fact, in a couple of them, I took them to account and I said, look, if you don't correct this, we'll be taking the issue further.
Yeah.
And so over time, through persistence, that's changed. But it's nominal in the fact that all that is they understand you better, which is good. We don't want factual errors to be in the picture. But we don't expect from better understandings that there to be any lightening of the struggle that we find to be natural.
I understand. That's great. Dear listeners, I would first of all like to say salams to our brother Mu'adh from Indonesia. He sent a message and asked that I say that to him, so his wife will think he's a big shot. So salam alaikum to brother Mu'adh. We're going to take a break, just a 3-minute break, inshallah. In the meantime, if you want to ask questions or call in off air, you're most welcome to do so. Our number is 972-433-55. We will be back after the break, inshallah.
مالك الملك لا شريك له وحده لا إله إلا هو مالك الملك لا شريك
And we're back. Jazakallah khairan. We have had no calls, just one person asking for a radio announcer who wasn't here, so that's all good, inshallah. There is a theory of a lesser Islamophobia and a greater Islamophobia. This theory, I read it in loonwatch.com, and it basically mentions that the lesser Islamophobia is a campaign by people to, you know, vilify Muslims, all Muslims, for, you know, financial gain or for other political gain, you know, to get more votes or whatever. But there is also the greater Islamophobia, which is when a country like the US, for example, wants to go to war with a Muslim country like Iraq or Afghanistan or Iran or Syria, they will raise the levels of Islamophobia by, for example, highlighting, terrorist or attempted terrorist attacks, etc., on American soil, so that people would feel more justified in invading countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, this connects as well with the last 400 years of colonization and the fact that to justify colonization to their people, Christian missionaries theorists and politicians have always tried to make Muslims or the East, Muslims being part of it, as being very backwards, very in need of the freedoms that the West offers. So this is how I'd like to discuss with you now in regards to how the media now presents Muslims. In the same way that it was presenting Muslims 100 years ago, the women are battered, they're covered behind their hijab and niqab, and they have to be freed from it, and the men are, you know, dangerous with big beards and angry eyes and, you know, a dagger in their hand.
Horses. Horses, you've got the horses.
And the horses, yes. So there's no horses now, there's just done-up cars in Bankstown. And before Brother Uthman, right? Yeah, Uthman, sorry. I was thinking Uthman Badr, so when I say Uthman by itself, it doesn't sound right. So before Brother Uthman shares this with us, inshallah, again, to any of our listeners, if you would like to call, our number is 972-433-55. Don't be shy. We will change your voice so people won't know who you are.
Please, Brother. Yeah, it's a very important part of the discussion, I think. But it goes back even much further than the beginning of colonization.
Yep.
Or colonialism. In fact, if I remember correctly, who was in the French Orientalist by the name of Count Henri de Castries, in a book he wrote titled Islam in the late 19th century, he writes that he'd be amazed, or he'd be amazed by what Muslims would think if they knew what in Europe people were saying about Muslims and singing in their hymns, not only saying, but in their hymns, which are religiously accredited, songs they sing in church, before the 12th century, i.e. before the Crusades. And he was saying that because they were all based on the presumption, which was ignorance, he said it himself, which is ignorance, that Muslims are idol worshippers, Muhammad was the Antichrist, they worship... like pagans,
yeah.
And so this has been part of the European and from there the Western psyche for a very long time. Now, if we come forward to the colonial period, then again it was used for political ends. So you want to conquer the land, you want to exploit the land, you have to, or the cultural aspect is part of the economic, the social, the political, and the military as well. Yeah. So, for example, the missionaries that went in first, even before the armies, as early as the 16th century, had missionaries in places like Malta, which is where it started, because that was the boundaries between the Ottoman Caliphate and Europe.
They had like a crusader thing there, the Knights of Malta, was it?
I think that's different. That's different. I'm not too sure about the Knights of Malta, but these are missionary schools. So, for example, later on, the American Association of Arts and Science, the Syrian Scientific Association, for example, in I think it was in about the 18th century or 19th century, 1820, where you had the first one in Beirut, where it really started. So for a long time, it was just... they were unsuccessful, and it spread from there to the rest of the Levant or Greater Syria.
Yep.
But the point is that what these associations were doing were, number one, stirring emotions of nationalism, which were later used to put the Arabs against the Turks and the Turks against the Arabs and so on and so forth. But they were also pushing specific ideas against Islam and pushing the Western culture. So that's common, that throughout Western history, they have used the cultural element and the ideological. Orientalism started on this basis, that there's an Orient. We need to understand why they're so backwards. Let's study them. But the study, particularly with Islam, was to show why it's wrong, not to understand it from a neutral academic perspective.
Yeah, for our listeners maybe who have always heard about Orientalism as a concept, but they don't really understand it, would you like to just sort of give us a few words about what it really means, what Orientalism means?
Yeah.
Was it started also by Edward Said, or did it always exist?
No, Edward Said's very late.
The identification of it is what I mean.
No. It's much, much before Edward Said. He just came later on and came up with theories that have found some acceptability amongst academics. Orientalism, I mean, the word Orient is the opposite of the Occident. The Occident is the West. Yeah. And the Orient defined in juxtaposition with this, which is a common approach, a political approach of defining people as opposed to you.
So it's not a geographical or regional location?
In origin, yes, but it's also got that ideological and the political connotations as well. But otherwise, the Occident is the West and the Orient is the East, mm-hmm. which is the way they defined it. So the Far East was China, the East was India and so forth, and the Middle East and so forth. So Orientalism is the study of the Orient. And it includes a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It includes study of China, of Asians and stuff they do, their culture. But part of it is study of Arabs and Muslims and Islam. But the point is that this study, when it first started, was part of the colonial project. It was part of, okay, let's understand these backward people who we're trying to conquer so that we can conquer them better. And the idea, part of that, was to show why Islam is wrong. And so a lot of the early studies are all about this, Goldseer's origins of Hadith. And they're quite deep. In fact, a lot of these Orientalists knew Arabic very well. They studied Islam quite deeply, but it was just that it wasn't a neutral, it wasn't a sincere approach.
Yep.
There have been some benefits. All students of Arabic will know that one of the best dictionaries is the Hans Wehr dictionary, which is written by a German Orientalist, because they knew the language and they needed to do these sort of stuff as well. So there's been positives as well. But by and large, it was part of the colonial project. If you will, the intellectual wing of colonialism.
Okay, that's great. Apparently my voice is not clear. I hope it's clearer now. So how does that connect? Let's first of all go into the war, the recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yep.
And then we'll move into more locally Australia. I mean, can you really say that this has anything to do with the invasion of Afghanistan, for example? I mean, the invasion of Afghanistan happened directly because of a direct attack by people from I don't know where.
Yeah.
Towards.
Yeah. The issue is it's not as if, you know, there's a new approach starts for a specific war. The issue is that colonialism, the approach before by Europe and Britain in particular, followed after World War II by America, is a constant process. So, and this is sometimes we have a problem. People think the war, you know, the Afghan war, the Iraq war, was the start of American aggression in the Middle East. It wasn't. From World War II and following that, particularly in Syria, a lot of people don't know the history of Syria and the Assad regime and how they came to power and the coups and the counter-coups in the 60s and 70s that were instigated by Europe and America fighting each other for influence in the region.
In the 60s, you say?
In the 60s.
This was while most of the Arab world was still under colonization.
Well, no, this is after, or physical colonization was over after independence,
okay.
But it's the period of proxy colonization. And this was a common approach across the region of coups, and there'd be a counter coup and another one. And in fact, eventually Hafez al-Assad came through with a coup to end all the other coups and with American patronage. But the point is that it's a continual process. So you've got this foreign enemy, if you will, which you're trying to dominate and maintain dominance over and exploit. So the process of demonizing them is also constant, and it continues. So it's not a case of, you know, we've come to the 1990s and now we need to make up something for the Afghan war. No, it's just a case of, yeah, okay, now the war, we can push it up. Yeah. We can up the ante in the media and in the press and the politicians.
Yeah.
And they do that. So, you know, George Bush didn't use the word crusade unknowingly. I don't want to say he's not an idiot. But the point is, he doesn't write his speeches. The speech writers write his speeches and they're checked and rechecked. Mm. And words are put in for political purposes deliberately. So you put the word in. It has its effect. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean crusade. I just meant we're going to go there too. You know, we're not against Islam. We're not against Muslims. We're just against the terrorists and so on and so forth. So it's more continual process.
This would fit with Hizb ut-Tahrir ideology and ideas. Others have actually said something completely different, that George Bush is an idiot, and sometimes he does make mistakes like that. And even, I don't know how much of a credibility that has, but Hamza Yusuf, for example, when he met Bush in the very beginning and he had hopes that maybe George Bush was not so much of a ideologue, he wanted to call it the war in Iraq, he wanted to call it just... What is it? Absolute justice?
Infinite justice.
Infinite justice. And, you know, Hamza Yusuf told him actually only God can, you know, exact infinite justice. And so they called it enduring freedom or something like that. So again, and also like with George Bush specifically, a lot of the things that he said didn't make any sense at all. So it doesn't then look like, you know, he has his, you know, speeches written so well and that every word coming out of his mouth has that ideology behind it.
As a specific example, I would argue he does have his speeches written, but at times you have to speak without a speech, and at times you have to, even if you have it written, but you're not very intelligent, you'll make mistakes. But the point is, by and large, politicians have their speeches written; they've got speechwriters, and any key speech, like a State of the Union address or an address that's going to be done before you're launching war, is not something the guy just writes up and goes out and says it. It's checked, it's rechecked. The cabinet will discuss it. What will this mean? What will implications this will have? This is the way it's done across the board. So, but the point is, the larger point is not negated by any of that. I don't think anyone out there would discount the fact that Islamophobia or the demonization of Islam and Muslims is used as a wing in the political endeavor to exploit and to implement the foreign policy in the Muslim world, which is the key point that is being made.
Okay, JazakAllah khairan. Now, moving then to Australia, do you think the same level of, you know, campaigning, I don't want to say against Islam, but, you know, for that purpose, is done in Australia as well, or to the same level that it's done in America?
It's done, it's the same essence. In essence, it's the same, but obviously the level and the intensity is obviously different, because Australia is not as active and as important as a player in the foreign policy as America or European nations are. But in essence, it's exactly the same, and we've seen examples of this. So, for example, you know, the burqa issue comes up. It's not Tony Abbott who starts it or Kevin Rudd who starts it. It's some side. It's Corey Bernardi starts it. He's a liberal party. He writes it on his blog. It's not even on his parliamentary website, but it's on his own blog, right? And again, that's not done unintentionally. So it's done as a blog. People say, oh, he said this. I didn't say this. It's personal opinion. Tony Abbott comes out and says, oh, it's his personal opinion, it's not the party position, but I can understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
I can understand why an issue to do with 0.001% of what Muslim women in the country do, he can understand the issue, right? So what Tony Abbott's doing, he's giving that ridiculous view, which should be absolutely rejected, and said, this is ridiculous. He's given it enough air to give it more. Kev Rudd said similar thing. The other people said, it's not our party policy, but it's something we think needs to be discussed.
Mm.
Right, and the issue moves on.
Do you think it's just they do it just to test the waters, see the response, see the media response, and then?
That's right. Well, there's different objectives at different times, but with the burqa, that's exactly what they wanted to do. They want to see the response of the media, the response of the Muslim community, as well, because if they want to say if it's complete silence, then they know that when we do need to do it. So when you want to plan a change, it's not you want to do it straight away. Test the waters. How are things? Can we do it in the future? What are the implications going to be? Because they can see it's going to happen in Europe. Are we going to need to follow as well? Which is why when it happened here, our approach was for the community to say, you can't stay silent. You have to say something.
Yeah.
You have to say, no, it's not acceptable. Have a say, have an intellectual say, an intelligent contribution to the debate.
Do you think that the Australian community, I mean the Muslim community in Australia, is able to provide an intellectual debate about this?
Absolutely. Obviously, I have no doubts about the ability. It's more a question of, there's an apprehension, because of the way the media works, because it's so hostile to anything Islam, Muslim. A lot of people are apprehensive of getting involved and of having missed. But otherwise, and then obviously we know that there's different organisations and there's a lack of unity that should probably be there on issues that are common. So I'm not saying we have to get rid of the differences, but there should be work on the issues that are common for everyone. And I think it's improving, like on the issue of Syria and others, but the point is that even if it's not a united stance, have your say what you want to say, because everyone in the community believed it was wrong, even if you didn't agree that wearing a niqab was obligatory.
Yeah.
But it's a political attack that has no basis. It wasn't Asia that brought it up. It wasn't the police that said, oh, we're having issues with pullover niqabis and, you know, they're giving us trouble. It was a politician. It was a politician who brought it up, and now we're being told it's a security concern, and now it's become a huge issue over a year, and then there's one case of Sister Matthews, and it's become a huge issue. But that's what they need, because now the public, the Australian, the wider community, for them it's a concern, it's a threat. So later on, if they say we're going to ban it, no one's going to say anything. The wider community, well, we understand, yeah, it's liberties and this, but we understand, and they're going to be able to go through with it, unless there is, you know, a more sustained effort to show that, no, we're not going to take this silently.
Mm. I think this is a question that's maybe already been answered, and we've asked this before to our other guests as well. Mm. When it comes to, you know, sentiments against Muslims, it seems to be that there are three different factors that contribute to it. First of all, there is general people's, I guess you could say, xenophobia or fear of the different, especially if a person, you know, has a massive beard, or he doesn't smile, or a woman, you know, wears hijab and doesn't shake hands. All these things, you know, they may cause concerns. Right. Then you have the media, who always seem to highlight, you know, stories including Muslims and violence, even though, you know, that act of violence or, you know, such incidents happen with any other community. And then you have politicians as well, which, as we've spoken about before, they have their own ideas of trying to catch up with, you know, Western policies. Which one feeds into the other? I mean, does it start from politicians and then, you know, rolls down to the media and the people started, or are the people already racist? You know, not, of course, all people, but I'm talking about are the elements in the community that have these feelings, the fuel that, you know, fires up the media and the politicians?
I think they go hand in hand, but obviously the influence as to direction and result comes from those who have influence, which is the media and the politicians, not the people.
Yep.
So, yes, certainly, as I said, in the psyche of the Westerner, if I can generalize, there is an apprehension of Islam at the very least, if not a complete distrust, and it's quite interesting actually. If you know, having heard a lot of stories of reverts or converts, you find normal people, absolutely normal people. These ones have come to Islam in the end. The story will start up like, "Oh, I used to be a Christian. I was born up as a Catholic, and the last thing on my mind ever would be to consider Islam as an option." Or when I started looking into different things, when I felt, you know, things were not good, the last thing I would have ever thought, and like, well, why would it be the last thing you ever thought? Is it something really, really bad? Mm. But these are normal people. These are not people that have an agenda against anyone. So it's there in the psyche. Now, but the issue is, how do you deal with this? If the media and the politician allowed for a neutral discussion, interaction of the Muslims, that would wither away, right? It would wither away. Because over time, when you see something and it goes against what you believe, you adjust. But what the media and politicians do, because they need to do it for their policies, domestic and foreign, is that they exacerbate those things and they reinforce them by this sensationalism, by this demonization. It's persistent. Mm. So they reinforce it, and then they're able to use it as well when they need to wage war or to institute a domestic policy. So that's the way I think it works.
Yeah. In terms of the media's representation of Muslims and how, you know, non-Muslim view Muslims in Australia, this, of course, is based on, you know, a campaign of, I guess, making Muslims look bad, vilifying Muslims. But it's also due to some real things that have happened, you know, real Muslims who have done, you know, horrible things, illegal things, who have completely thrown the law away. So it can't be said that it's, you know, completely fabricated. These things do happen, right? How much do you think of a contribution does Hizb ut-Tahrir do in contributing to that sentiment? I ask this because you mentioned before that Hizb ut-Tahrir's focus is basically on telling the truth as it is to the media, and especially when it comes to, you know, the wars in Syria and Afghanistan and all these things. A lot of times that I myself, a Muslim, knowing what Hizb ut-Tahrir is all about, when I hear what you guys say on the media, it just seems that you deliberately try to say the most controversial things, right?
It's like you're purposely provoking.
Yeah. Like there is a sentiment, for example, an idea that Muslims, you know, want to kill Australians. And then you come out and you say, well, if Afghans kill Australians, that's Australians' fault. And you don't try to sort of, you know, put it into context or into a protocol, or you don't even, like, you know, it's not like you try and they stop you. You just don't have that.
Okay, I'll take that in two questions. The first one was, how much do Muslims generally contribute? As I said, certainly there are Muslims that do wrong things, but I think that's a needle in the haystack with respect to what else is happening out there. In other words, even if they didn't do that, that would not stop the media storm that occurs. Nevertheless, Muslims, that's not an excuse, Muslims, the number one way to respond to all this, which is a topic which probably we may not be able to cover today, is by behaving as Muslims in word and deed in everything they do. The second part, are we purposefully provoking? It's certainly not a policy to be purposefully provoking. The issue is that our area of focus is in an area that is inherently controversial, and it's at the core of the battle of hearts and minds and the ideas. And if I could draw a parallel, obviously, I would go back to the age of the Prophet ﷺ in Mecca, where it's the same scenario that what he's saying, right, however he says it, and in fact even the way he says it, is controversial. And it's not because of the style he's using or the words he's saying or the things he's not saying. It's because he's challenging long-held beliefs and practices with a very clear and concise idea that is diametrically opposed to what they have. And he's shaking the society by that ideologically. All right. So if we see, for example, وَيْلٌ لِلْمُطَفِّفِينَ, economic practices, and the child that is buried alive, and the ideas, and the idol worship. And this is, however you say it, right, and obviously the issue on the media, you have to be concise, you have to try and get the message across very succinctly, and with the right emotion as well, it's going to be controversial. As regard the Prophet ﷺ, when his very first public address on Mount Safa, when he said, you know, if I told you there's army behind me, would you believe me? And they said, yes, we've never come across a lie with you. First thing he said to them was, then I am a messenger, for inni nadhirun lakum bayna yaday adhabin aleem. I'm a warner coming to you in front of, warning you of an imminent severe torment. And he started calling the tribes by their names, save yourself from the fire, save yourself from the fire. And straight away from that point onwards, there was controversy and the struggle and the conflict and so on and so forth. To the extent that, for example, a very good example that the Quran itself mentions this, which all Muslims know, is the first words of Jaz'amma, Amma yatasa'alun, some people translate it as about what are they asking, but it's not really that, because it's not saying Amma yas'alun. Amma yatasa'alun from Bab Tafa'ul, which has denotations of reciprocity, groups. In other words, about what is the reverberating discussion and questioning amongst the people. And that's what they were discussing, Day of Judgment. He's saying this, it's Quran, is it right, is it wrong?
All right, could I ask you now, in the context of Australia,
yep,
has there been a positive effect with your tactic, essentially? You are very, I find that you guys are very straightforward. You don't really beat around the bush and you say it how it is. Mm. Has there been a positive effect with that sort of tactic?
Yeah, obviously.
With the media?
With the media, I think there has. As I said, there's been some changes in the information that they put out. But the point is, that question can only be measured by what positive thing were you expecting in the first place?
Well, so right? They can stop talking about Muslims and...
That's not going to happen. That's not. If you're expecting that positive, it's always going to be negative.
Really?
to be very frank, because the point is...
So then you're in a way, you're always expecting the worst, so...
No, it's not a case of expecting the worst. It's a case of being realistic. I'm not being realistic. I shouldn't say that as an ideologue. But okay, it's a case of understanding the reality that what's behind all this is not a journalist who doesn't know about Islam. It's the fact that the struggle is natural. It has to take place. Unless you step back and you say, well, I'm not going to say anything about Islam, right? And we're not going to challenge you. You can do whatever you want in the Muslim world. You can do whatever you want here, which is not an option. But if you engage, then they have an idea and you have an idea, and these are diametrically opposed. There's going to be a struggle until and unless one dominates the other. And until then, the struggle is going to... So the positive you're looking for is there are sincere elements in the society. There are some sincere elements in the media. There are sincere elements in academia. You want to try and win them, or at the very least to neutralize them. That's the best you can do. And if that's a bleak assessment of the reality, that's the case. And again, I would bring everyone back to the seerah of the Prophet ﷺ. He's the best dawah carrier. He couldn't do it better than he did it. And that's what he was presented with. So if we think we can do it in a more subtle way, or we can do it in a way that there'll be
maybe
less conflict.
Maybe a bit more diplomatic.
No, but even if my point is the results, whatever way you use, if you think you can do it in a way that results in less conflict and less struggle than the Prophet, then there's something wrong. So the point is, the issue is understanding the way the media works, that it's part of the establishment, it's not this neutral institution on the side, and understanding the nature of the struggle that is before us, that really allows us to
assess. There are different maybe natures of struggle, and maybe the context of the Prophet's da'wah in Mecca is not the same as the struggle here. But that's a completely different argument, and inshallah we may bring you in to have that in at a later time, inshallah.
Sure. Maybe we can sort of conclude on where to from here.
Yeah, I've got a question actually.
Oh, you've got a question, sorry.
Ask a question and then we could ask where to from here. So this is from Sister Anna Rose from Kunambul. She says, it seems as though Hizb ut-Tahrir have quite a negative view of Western society. And, hold on one second. Western society. And that the group is focused on creating an Islamic system in the Islamic world. Why then is the majority of HC activity seemingly conducted within Western countries rather than in the actual societies where HC seeks to create change? I.e., why don't the people who feel so strongly about creating or shaping a change go and participate in the change that is being wrought right now in those very societies? So basically, why don't you go back where you came from?
There's, I think, two questions being asked there. And because it was so long, I think I fought on the first one. But the as to the second one, as to seemingly was the key word there. The majority of our work is in the Muslim world. The majority of our members are in the Muslim world. But obviously for a person who lives in the West and naturally comes into contact more with news and interaction with members and with activities and with what's happening in the West, it may seem that we have more work in the West, but it's certainly not the case. The vast majority of our work is in the Muslim world. And the stuff we do here, as I said, and this is why we don't just go back where we came from, is because there's an important role to be played here.
Yep.
And there's things you can do here that are far better, more effective than you can do there. And so we do that rather than to go back and...
Jazakallah khairan. I would also have accepted the answer of we're here because of what the West has done to the Muslim world, forcing us to leave it and come to the West. Some people have said that. I've heard that answer
before. Well, it's natural. I mean, the point is, it's not as if we sent members to Australia to start to provoke the media or anything like that.
Yeah.
Muslims were here. Some of those Muslims happened to be members of Hizb ut-Tahrir, and so they organized themselves and said, well, what can we do to help the effort back home?
Hmm.
And over time, that's developed. And that's the natural way in a globalized world things work.
Yeah. Jazakallah khairan. 1 minute. Where to from here? What's the future for you? In 1 minute, because we have to finish after that.
The media and Hizb ut-Tahrir.
Yeah.
Well, as I said, there's the struggle that is before us, which is between secular liberalism and Islam, will only intensify. The way forward, the way we see the way forward, is for Muslims across the world to engage in the way that they can. And obviously, in the Australian context, that's not talking about military intervention or raising swords or anything like that, but it's getting involved. And really, I think this is the key point with the media. Either you engage or you disengage. And I think most people agree that we need to engage, but the engagement should be on the basis of understanding how the media works and understanding what we seek to achieve, what Muslims seek to achieve through the... Is it just local benefits, just local objectives, or as an ummah, do we have broader objectives that need to be considered?
Jazakallah khairan, Brother Athman.
Well, yeah.
We unfortunately come to the end of our show. We would first of all like to thank Brother Athman Badr for coming on the show and for discussing these ideas with us. Jazakallah khairan.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Podcasts on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran tafsir, and seerah are available at islampodcasts.com as well as on iTunes. Rate, review, and comment, and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please subscribe, share, and tell a friend about IslamPodcasts.com.